what I'll invent. I'll have pockets all round the table, and we'll shove sugar balls in them. No, balls. Lots of balls. And we'll have little sticks to prod them with, and we'll have chalk on the end to stop them slipping, and it'll be a game. A wonderful, marvellous new game.
Welcome to the Objective Secure podcast. My name's Mike.
And I'm Emma.
And this is episode 18, Simple Hammer. We're going to talk all things gaming with our kids, basically. We're going to talk about getting the next generation of potential players into not just tabletop gaming, but board gaming and card gaming, and basically how we can bring them to carry on after and give us new opponents as they get older. It's going to be focused on the younger generation today.
Yeah, if we don't start bringing new blood into the game, what's going to happen?
Yeah, exactly. And we've seen a few times over the years where some of the companies have gotten involved and kind of reached out into those younger marketplaces. Magic the Gathering have seen resurgences over the years as they change tactics and engage different parts of the population. And certainly Games Workshop's seen its fair share of ups and downs around The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings games as that became popular with some of the younger generation again. Obviously, Tolkien's been around a lot longer than the early 2000s, but
a little bit.
Obviously, that's that played a fairly big part in bringing another generation of gamers into Games Workshop. And obviously, there's board games as well that a lot of families will have around in the home. And when we say board games, let's just be clear, we're not talking Monopoly here.
Just in case you haven't heard one of our podcasts or Facebook Lives. So I think all Monopoly games should be burnt, and the person who designed and developed Monopoly should spend eternity in a little special place in hell.
She's not jaded, and she's certainly not biased in that regard, is she?
Monopoly's awful. It is absolutely terrible. I know some people love it, but it's just, yeah.
It could be worse.
No, I don't think it could.
No,
it goes on forever, and it causes massive arguments.
No, we're talking proper board games here, so there's a whole raft on them. And board games have seen a massive resurgence in recent years, as we've had more innovative, dynamic actual game systems developed, and we've seen cards introduced into board games and different dice mechanics, and obviously the introduction of miniatures more heavily into the board game community as well has seen a slight shift in the paradigm with what you can expect for out of a big box game. Mm. And for the price you pay for a big box game these days, you're talking, for Australians at least, anywhere from $50 to $200, depending on what sort of big box game you're actually buying. The quality has increased significantly over the years, and we're now seeing more and more that those big box games are a great introduction for the younger generation into board gaming and learning rules and managing game mechanics. And then obviously, if you slant that a little bit into science fiction or fantasy, then it's very easy to see the logical leap from board games to proper tabletop games. And there's now even more and more products that segue that more gently. Thinking specifically about Games Workshop and our last episode about Shadespire, mm-hmm. That's certainly a stepping stone into full-blown tabletop gaming from Games Workshop direct. And it's same with Necromunda. So those companies are now getting very savvy about how they engage with the younger audience. The buy-ins tend to be a lot lower than tabletop gaming. And
even actually looking at something like Underworlds, it's actually really affordable. Like in the board game kind of market there, like you were saying, board games priced from $50 to $200. I'm not sure that you can actually get a decent game for $50.
I think there's games like Munchkin and some of the more simple card-driven games, but certainly for any sort of miniatures game, thinking about Zombicide specifically, because that's another one that we own, the base version of Zombicide, I think, is at least $100.
Yeah.
And then the expansions are anywhere from $50, $60. I'm from memory, I could be wrong there. So Shadespire certainly fits in that space. Yeah. The difference being, of course, that Zombicide took us, what, an hour to figure out how to play. Actually, you know what? Shadespire was about the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
There's a lot more alcohol involved when we were learning Zombicide as well.
That's true. And the kids haven't played that one yet either, so...
And definitely not with alcohol involved.
No. but I suppose we should touch on the reason that we're at this topic for today's episode is the announcement from Games Workshop around Warhammer Adventures.
Yeah.
It's quite an exciting... And it's been very polarizing in the online community since the announcement, which was the 21st of May, I believe it was, that they're going to be doing a series of books that are aimed squarely at sort of that 8 to 12-year-old generation of players that can be engaged, like their imagination can get engaged with the worlds that Games Workshop produces. The
stories behind it.
And then hopefully, obviously, from the company's point of view, lead them into becoming a hobbyist as they get that little bit older and... they're, you know, the parents are already seeing that engagement at younger years. Certainly, I think this is an interesting step for them because they've gone...
do you know, I'm sorry to cut you off there, but I actually don't know that it's going to take... So you're sort of thinking that get them into reading the stories when they're sort of 8 to 12, then when they get a couple of years older, they'll start buying and painting models. But I actually think that we're going to see a lot of 8 to 12-year-olds reading the stories and wanting the models.
Not absolutely.
Necessarily wanting to play with them straight away.
Yeah.
But certainly wanting to collect them, build them, paint them.
I'm almost assuming at this point that, and I hope, who knows if I'm right or wrong, but I'm assuming that we'll get some push-fit miniatures sometime early 2019 when these are due to be released. Of the main characters in the books.
In an ideal world, they'd come, you know, like...
Pre-painted. I suppose, I mean, Games Workshop could take that angle, but I assume we'll get them as clan packs that you'll have to build and paint yourself because that's obviously part of the hobby that Games Workshop will want to promote and be part of. But I think it's a really interesting way of engaging because I remember as a kid, part of the thing that hooks you, well, certainly that hooked me when I was 10 or 11 years old when we first started seeing this stuff was around... actually, probably been 12 or 13 now I think about it. Milton Bradley had released Hero Quest and Space Crusade. Mm. All the artwork was awesome. You got these big space marines with guns fighting all these space orcs and all the rest of it. And you start getting snippets of some of the stories from the Rogue Trader era. And that's the stuff that I remember. I still remember some of the stories from the original Harlequin stuff from the 1989 compendium. And that's the stuff that sees me still buying Harlequin models to this day because it's so ingrained in my gaming history that maybe this is their next way of engaging their next veteran hobbyists that 30 years later are still playing.
Yeah.
It's an exciting thing for, and it's certainly, like I say, been a very polarizing project since its announcement because some hobbyists seem to have taken it on themselves that it's not an appropriate setting for younger audiences. And certainly the grim, dark side of Games Workshop's 40K setting could potentially cause some consternation among parents if they don't really know what they're looking at and dealing with.
Yeah, and it's not helped that on the website it says some parents have concerns over exposing their children to a...
Oh, to the Horus Heresy series.
The Horus Heresy, you know, nine sons trying to tear down their father's empire.
Yeah, and we know that's tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, definitely, but is it much different to what else is out there?
Well, when you start talking about Greek mythology and... some of the stories they're taught in school these days around, you know, the gods and like the Roman gods and Norse mythology, all that sort of stuff has a lot.
I was thinking Star Wars, but sure.
I'm actually thinking about less nerd-driven. You know, this is the stuff that all the kids learn in schools. There's generally some sort of subject on Egyptian pantheon or the Norse pantheon, those sorts of stories and mythology and whatnot. We tend to see in Australian schools at some point in time.
Yeah, well, certainly the mythology is covered in the Year 7 curriculum for HASS.
Yeah.
So
and a lot of the themes that, you know, obviously humans being humans, we use that experience to write our own stories. So a lot of the themes and stuff covered in the Horus Heresy are reminiscent of some of the Egyptian pantheon stories and the Norse and all the rest of it. So... some of the names are lifted directly from those things.
Yeah, notice they're all getting changed now, though.
No, like Horus. Horus was an Egyptian god, and he's the main protagonist, or not protagonist. I suppose he is the protagonist. Main villain in the Horus Heresy series. He's got a heresy named after him. And it explains why he's named Horus and where that name actually came from. And it actually references the histories. So yeah. I feel like there's a sort of a leading connection there where any of the children who are innately interested in that sort of myths and legends stuff at that age, that sort of 10, 11, 12 years old, can sort of very easily be drawn in through the right sort of stories around similar themes. So this seems like a really interesting way of doing that. And there's plenty of other books out there that do just that. But, you know, and then obviously from there you get all the board games and the card games and moving full-blown to tabletop wargaming as well. So the world is their oyster at this age, as long as they find something they enjoy and that...
God, if they're reading, it's awesome.
Yeah, in this day and age, absolutely.
Yeah,
mind you, one of ours never has her nose out of a book, so...
And it's now way past his bedtime, but the other one's got his nose stuck in a book at the moment as well, so... our kids are readers, which is awesome, but there's a lot of kids out there that struggle to find engaging books that excite them and make them want to read. If there's something out there that's going to encourage kids to read, I don't care if they're reading the back of a toilet paper packet. If they're reading something, give it to them.
Well, this looks like it's been well thought out as well. They've got a fairly diverse range of characters. They've got proper authors writing them. They're not... dumbing them down necessarily like they could easily do.
Yeah.
And the artwork looks, you know, it's certainly not the typical 40K grim dark or even Age of Sigmar. The new Age of Sigmar stuff can be pretty full on and bleak, but this artwork and these characters seem very much aimed at a younger audience. They're a bit brighter. They're less hyper realistic. There's more relatable archetypes, I suppose, for the average kids and the readers. It's an interesting it's an interesting route they've gone down for the characters in particular. But we're going to take a very short break and then we're going to come back and start talking Simple Hammer and how you can get your kids into gaming and what games we might have and have played with our kids that we can recommend. And then obviously how young is too young before you start playing tabletop. So we're going to talk Simple Hammer now, and before we go too far into it, I'd like to share where the name Simple Hammer came from, at least in my vocabulary. I have to give a shout out to a very good friend of mine, Brett, who doesn't live in Western Australia anymore. He now lives over in Queensland, but I remember him sharing a story with me when he was first teaching one of his kids, who is now, I'm trying to think how old his oldest must be, 15 or 16?
I think that he would be 18.
Oh, that's a shocking, shocking thing to think about. He was teaching him Warhammer, specifically Warhammer 40,000. And he was trying to teach, he would have been maybe 10 years old. And the dice mechanics for Warhammer are fairly straightforward, but I say that knowing them. So
it's a lot to take in.
Yeah, rather than trying to throw all the rules at his son, he decided to invent what he called Simple Hammer, which was essentially rolling dice, getting used to the sequence and the mechanics with very fixed numbers for the kids to play. So it was always a 3 or higher to hit, it was always a 4 or more to wound, and it was always a 5 or more to save. And the measuring tapes, like you always measured the same distances, so they always moved 6, they always shot 24. And it was, as they got more comfortable with the processes and the theory behind the processes, you could then start changing some of those dynamics where you started going, oh, well, this guy doesn't hit as well, so he only hits on 4s, but his gun's better, so it wounds on 2s. So you can start slowly introducing them to the different scales within the band range of the D6 model and kind of get them used to that formula. So I have to give props to Brett because he came up with that many years ago now. It'd be probably a decade or so now, if you're right, with his son's age. And it stuck with me a very long time, to the point where it's certainly something that I'd more than happily recommend for parents to try with their, for gaming parents to try with their kids. So yeah, a special shout out there for Brett. So thanks very much, Matt. But let's talk about, what games we've had some success with teaching our kids and how old they need to be to play some of them, and sort of what got them into it in the first place. So I mentioned there's a whole bunch of books out there. So one of the ones that we've seen a lot of interest in our house is from, what's the author's name?
So there's an author, Rick Riordan, and he writes the Percy Jackson series and Heroes of Olympus and a whole heap of books, which our eldest has been reading since she was probably 10. Yeah, probably about 10. And I read them as well because she was so excited and enthusiastic about them. And this probably might also cover one of the questions that we were asked by Justin around ways that you can encourage people into the game. So they're all based on the different myths and legends. So basically all of the different...
things like the Medusa, the Minotaur, all of those sorts of Greek and Roman gods and...
Yeah, so the main characters are children of those gods. And whether that... so the...
so Zeus and Hades and Poseidon?
Yes. That's in the Percy Jackson series. And then when you go into the... so the Heroes of Olympus is the same gods. And then there's a different series which is based on the Egyptian gods, which has got the Horus and...
those Ra and...
yeah, I can't remember. And then I haven't read that series because it's not finished yet. And I'm... a little bit obsessive about things, and if I finish a book I need to pick the next one up straight away and read the whole series, and I'll sulk if I have to wait till September for the next one to come out. So I haven't
read it's one of the yet. Reasons why she hasn't watched Game of Thrones either, because that last season doesn't come out till next year.
Yeah. Not happening. And then there's another one which is set with I actually can't remember, but so they're set in different kinds of mythology.
Yeah.
So it covers this huge broad range of mythology, and what I found from that was listening to you two comparing, you know, when you were talking about the different 40K characters and going, okay, well, does your book have something about this in it? And then she would then give a 20-minute spiel about the whole backstory of this, and then you would then go, oh, yeah, well, in this there's...
Yeah, that conversation was a really bizarre one, actually, because it started... she mentioned a character and then... I went, oh, that, you know, or maybe I mentioned a character, and she went, oh, that's based on this. And it was around Fenris, the wolf.
Yes.
And obviously that's straight out of mythology, the wolf that devours the moon and all the rest of it. And Fenris being the name of a planet in Warhammer 40,000 that is the home to the space wolves. And then as we sort of moved through and around some of the other names and some of the stories that are attached to those characters in Warhammer, it became very clear that there was... Some artistic license used in interpreting some of the myths
slightly
and legends.
More than parallel, more like yeah. Totally taking.
Almost lifted word for word in some cases. But it certainly gave us a common point of conversation there where she could use names to create direct references to Warhammer characters and vice versa.
Yeah, and we had, because she does have such an incredible love of history and mythology, we had looked at encouraging her to play one of the Roman games.
Oh, some of the historical type stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, we looked at that. But now, I guess, because she can see the links between Warhammer 40K and all of this mythology, she's now a lot more inclined to get involved.
Yeah. I mean, when you actually wind the clock back far enough, we've got photos of her and her younger brother. And then obviously a little bit further, when you spin the clock back forward a little bit, their younger sister as well. The three of them sat there painting with Dad.
Yeah.
Just because they wanted to do art and craft with Dad while Dad was painting. And I think that's something that'll happen with every child, particularly when they see it enough around the home. And it's good. You know, I mean, my 5-year-old, she sat on my lap and she's airbrushed before. Yeah. And
often
she's
on her hands and
yeah,
arms.
But that's fine. Like, you know, she gets a kick out of it.
We've still got her miniatures that live in our cutlery drawer.
Yeah, because that's where she decided they lived.
Yep.
And I think that...
there's no place for the knives anymore, but we've got...
plastic knives of doom. But those sort of interactions, I think, are very natural for kids because they want to do that painting and craft side of things. But then when you can take that and apply it to that sort of more education-related connection where they are interested in reading and some of the mythologies and stuff, and then they're still interested and want to learn more about the game and the stories that attach to it, then all of a sudden you've now got that triple connection of story plus game plus hobby. It's that sort of perfect trinity that happens, and kids can be quite engaged because they've got something they can physically do, a point of competition, and then stuff they can read and learn about. So I think it can be very good for them.
And I guess that's why I struggle with the whole idea that parents are concerned that their kids are reading this, because if you do actually read, I mean, gosh, if you do go back and read the actual mythology, it's really dark.
Oh, yeah.
And I think our kids are exposed to a lot. Like, I obviously want to keep our kids as innocent as we can for as long as possible, but I don't think that they really take this stuff.
No. I suppose that the concern that a lot of people have voiced over the last couple of days since the announcements was around the way they're going to portray certain things in the adventure series compared to how they're portrayed in the main stories. Because if you've got Space Marines in the adventure series being these upstanding, like, essentially white knights, they're walking around as the golden knights in armor that protect everyone and are awesome and everyone loves them, and, you know, they are literally the Sir Lancelots of the story, compared to the way they're actually portrayed in the grim dark stories, where they are these warrior monks who will execute entire planets to keep chaos away, and they're two very polarizing personality types.
But that's the same thing. You know,
it's a different portrayal, is what I'm saying.
That's the same as, it's a different portrayal. If you look at watching, okay, I'm going to show my age a little bit, but if you look at watching the Robin Hood cartoon with the fox as Robin Hood and the snake as Sir Hiss, and then you look at the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves movie, like, it's a very different portrayal.
You didn't even come to this century, did you? You stayed in the
I know.
In the 20th century.
Well, the only other one I could think of was Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, Robin Hood Men in Tights.
No, we're still the same. Still the same. Okay.
But
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I see what you're saying there. I mean, the introduction to the character at that age, for Robin Hood in particular, from that Disney cartoon, is meant to be an engaging thing about robbing from the rich and giving to the poor, and you kind
but it's
of gloss
a good
over
guy who's
yeah, and you gloss over the negative sides and all the violence and stuff to yeah. show a fun story that
you
kids
look at the kids of the tales of King Arthur. You look at that compared to the adult version of that with adultery and murder and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
It's just, you're portraying Space Marines as the good guys who are looking after you. How they go about that, you don't need to go into details.
No, and I also suspect that one of the reasons they've picked the Necrons in the books as the first antagonist is purely so they don't have to spread blood and guts everywhere when the combat starts, because you're fighting robots. So I'd be interesting. It'll probably be one that I'd actually like to pick up and read and share with my kids, because I'd be really interested to see how they engage the source material, because this source material isn't exactly like Love and Roses. It's pretty bleak stuff.
I think by the time it comes out, our kids are actually going to be, our older kids are going to be too old for it, and our youngest is going to be still too young.
I think our second child is probably at the tail end of the target audience, but I think he'd still have an interest in it. So it'd be interesting to see when they say 2019, but that could mean January or December, who knows?
Yeah, that's it.
So as we get more information, it'll be interesting to see when that is, because I think it's something I'd really like to see and read myself, just to see what the goal is there and how they're going to portray this going forward. But why don't we talk about other games other than tabletop to start with, and what we've had success with kids, and maybe some of the games that haven't gone down so well. I mean, obviously any of the party game type stuff that we've... there's just some of the more classic stuff like, what do you call it? Twister and all those sorts
Twister, Pictionary.
You know, they're fine.
Scattergories.
Scattergories kind of falls into the same thing as Monopoly, though, when you start talking about words and stuff and arguments over what's in the dictionary and not. But from a board...
Scrabble.
one of the first board games we actually got was Catan, Settlers of Catan.
Yeah.
And
so we got this, our youngest would have been 3.
Yeah, which makes the oldest 10 or 11 at the time.
Yep.
And we got Catan, I'd played it a couple of times pre-purchase. I don't think you'd ever played it before.
No.
And we had the older two playing with us and the littlest wanting to join in within a game or two of playing it. And, well, it probably took three games before the older two had a firm grasp on it. Not even that. And they're quite confident in playing that now. They can play that. Well, they have played it one-on-one at one point there. And fairly intuitive game, but it teaches them that resource management thing. It teaches them about dice. It teaches them about some of the strategy around where you put your roads and your castles and things.
It's interesting playing with them because they, they're not... They're interesting kids, the way they play. It's not about, if I do this, I'll win. It's, oh, I need this and you need that. So let's swap and then we can both, feel, you know, get the road that we want or get the house that we want or that kind of thing. So they kind of don't really think strategically in a way that, whereas when you and I are playing it, there is no way I'm giving up those bricks because I'm not letting you get.
Yeah, certainly the level of lateral thinking probably isn't applied there. I imagine as they get older, and certainly our oldest, she's just turned 13, she's probably more likely to do that these days because the second game that I wanted to talk about was Werewolf.
Yeah.
Which is a very, very common game for us to play in the evenings for a round or two before bed. And it's a card-driven game. It's like a bluffing game where you essentially are assigned a role at random and then you go through this sort of 2 or 3 minute sequence using an app or a dungeon master or, you know, depending on your level of resources. And then you have to figure out who is the werewolf and who is innocent. If you've ever played an online mafia game in any of the forums, you'll know roughly what I'm talking about. It's basically the same process.
So this game was actually introduced to us by our now 13-year-old. So last year as part of her, I can't remember if it was part, so house is...
Is it health?
No, it's not. What is it? Humanities and Social Services.
There you go.
So I think it was part of a house program. They played it as a class.
Yeah.
And she just kept going on and on and on about this game and how much she loved it. And I'd never heard of it before. And so we got it for her.
Well, as she was explaining it to me, the original online version of Mafia was actually called Werewolf.
Yeah.
And that's, I assumed the way she was talking, that was the general transition to a tabletop board game style game. And yeah, we picked it up for her last year as the first of three so far.
Yeah.
And
it's one night.
One night is the brand and then Werewolf is the first.
No, but it happens in one night.
Yes.
So that's the difference between the Mafia game that you were talking about.
Where it's online, weeks or months.
Whereas the one night version, which we play, lasts 5 minutes maximum. Yeah. So it's really quick, it's really snappy, and everyone can hold their attention for that length of time. Everyone struggles to keep their eyes closed, but can hold their attention for that.
And look, that's been a really good one for our youngest to get involved with. She's, well, like any five-year-old, she's driven purely by her own self-interests at the moment. And she can be a bit funny with if she gets the wrong character that she doesn't like. But at the same time...
And heaven forbid if anyone tries to swap cards with her.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
But what it does do is it's teaching her about that winning and losing side of things with the game. It's teaching her a little bit about bluffing. It's teaching her a little bit about game mechanics.
Yeah.
And she gets the game. She can play the standard version of the game quite happily by herself. The tokens version, as you go through the different games, the third one's called Vampire, and it starts introducing different tokens and different effects. And that's fiddly for me.
Yeah, it is. You got to pay attention. So I was just thinking as well, one of the benefits for the Werewolf game with our five-year-old is from the age of four, her reading was, you know, she can read psychic, seer, robber, all of those kinds of things. So
yeah, because she needed to learn what the cards said because she wanted to know.
That's it. So I'm not sure her pre-primary teacher understands necessarily why our child can
troublemaker and doppelganger. Yeah. Or what was the vampire? It's like the psychic vampire. It's this weird word, and it's a Y for vampire as well. So, But yeah, like that's been really good for us for the kids. It's a quick game. We play 2 or 3 rounds after dinner, and it's a really easy one to have around the dinner table because you're all already sat there. So that's been really popular for us and for all the kids. And we've had
all the kids, like
three of them.
Yeah, but I was about to say, and when people come over for dinner and they have to play whether they want to or not. So
We've had a few of my friends have to sit down and play with our kids, and we've had them bring friends over and play as well. And the best thing about it is the game will accommodate.
My parents playing as well. There was one time when my parents were playing, and my dad just totally forgot to have his turn.
And fell asleep. Because you have to play with your eyes closed for part of the game. So that's probably, of any of these sorts of games that are more intricate, that's probably a really good place to start for any of the younger players that you might want to get involved with. Obviously, the earlier you introduce them to these sorts of games, the easier they'll find it. And if you've got a young 6 or 7 year old, they might already be playing board games with you, and this will be something that just adds to the exposure in regards to mechanics and how to play games. Catan was a bit more difficult to teach our youngest.
Yeah, but we just played. So she and I would play on the same team, and we talked it through, and you know, now she can play by herself.
Yeah, look, I mean, again, the games are less focused on winning with her, but and you make concessions like anyone would for a younger player. But certainly those two games have gone down really well with our kids. We've also done things like Ticket to Ride, which is a little bit more complicated again because there is some strategy involved and you have to start looking. If you've not seen it, it's basically a railroad game where you're trying to build a sequence of railroads around a board. And that takes a little bit more time and patience because you've got to figure out where you're going and
how you can have the longest road
and
what happens when somebody invariably
blocks you.
Yeah.
Now you go around it.
Where you're going to go and what options have you got left.
And drawing cards and that sort of sequence as well. So there is a little bit more to Ticket to Ride for the younger audience. The other one we've done is Smash Up, which is more complicated again because it takes like you get ninja pirates and alien dinosaurs and sort of you smash up two archetypes and then you're trying to take over bases, and that actually got quite complicated. Particularly,
I'm gonna be honest, I struggled with that one. haven't played it enough for me to feel confident. There's no way I could pick that box up and play that game.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Once you hit that point, you're kind of at this weird space where you really want. I don't think that's one that I would play with sort of 10 to 12-year-olds. I think you kind
of... Definitely not with our 5-year-old.
No.
It's way too hard with her.
You kind of hit that wall of, no, this is clearly aimed at teenage or above.
Yeah.
Because you do have to pay attention. You do have to be able to be cognizant about what's on the cards and, you know, how you string together some of the abilities as well.
Yeah, that's it. So you need to have... It's something that I think you've got to play quite a bit to develop your knowledge around what the different races do and how when you put them together they might work together and how they go against other races, all of that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah. And then the biggest big box game we've tried with them is Fury of Dracula.
Fury of Dracula, yeah.
Sadly out of print these days. You can still find it here and there. It was previewed on Tabletop with Will Wheaton on YouTube, which is where I saw it for the first time. And the rights to it were actually owned by Games Workshop until recently.
Were they not supposed to be re-releasing it? Didn't I read that somewhere?
It was produced by Fantasy Flight Games up until recently, and then the license has gone. And I don't know whether or not Games Workshop will re-release it, because as far as I understand it, they do still hold the rights to it.
I thought I read at the end of last year that it was supposed to be being re-released because I'd saw
that... Oh, that was Fantasy Flight releasing their own version because they didn't... They didn't own the brand, as in Van Helsing and Dracula, but they owned the mechanic. So we could very well see a version of Fury of Dracula relabeled Fury of the Vampire or something like that with different characters in it. The game itself, though, is a 2.5 hour marathon big box game that has bluffing, that has a lot of...
It is one of the most fun and infuriating games I have ever played.
I love this game. I haven't played it as the Hunters yet. I love playing Dracula.
No, because you won't give up
Dracula. No, because Dracula is awesome fun to play. So there's a secret move sequence for the vampire, so you've basically got to try and stay ahead and second guess where the Hunters are going. The Hunters have got to try and find you and then hunt you down and kill you. And we've never finished a game of it with the kids. It's just not possible. They lose interest, an hour and a half in, give or take.
I'm going to be honest, I lost interest 3 hours in for one of the games that we did. Yeah.
But it is a very fun game because I think with the right group of adults and everyone working together...
It's fun until Dracula hits the water and then it's not fun anymore. Then it is so frustrating because you have no idea where he's gone. just pin him down, then he hits the water.
We might even have to do a full-length video of this game.
No,
with
no
someone.
One wants to see 3 hours of that.
It wouldn't be 3 hours with the right players. But it is a really fun game to play. And that, I think, is well past where our kids are at the moment in terms of completing a version of that game. Mm. That definitely feels like a late teen, young adult, maybe mid-teen. But I think the attention span required and the level of tactical thinking and the level of...
Yeah, that's it. I know when we've played, because it does take a lot of strategy and it does take a lot of, like you say, tactical thinking. So when I'm playing with the three kids, it's only me.
Yeah.
Going through and
second guessing and working it through, yeah.
Whereas, yeah, it would certainly help when you've got other adults there to go, hang on, what about this and how does this work?
And I think that'd dramatically shorten the playtime. Yeah. Because if you've got three or four people playing the Hunters against one other adult playing the Vampire, you would have a shorter game purely because you've actually got four minds thinking about the problem and processing those problems and then trying to come up with an answer. It's one that probably the more you drink is probably a less sensible way of playing the game because you'll fast lose track of what's going on. It is a high-intensity game.
Yeah, you do have to really be paying attention.
Yeah. And I think it sits on a very similar par to any of the super expansive board games of a similar ilk where they're a really technical game. You could even argue some of the things like Risk and...
like I said before, I won't play Risk because somebody who loves Monopoly loves Risk, so therefore Risk must be terrible. No, we've got it, but I'm not playing it, ever.
One of the big box games I used to play, I would have been mid-teen. I think it's called Sword of the Samurai these days. But it was originally called Shogun when I first played it.
Mm.
And that's a ancient feudal Japan-style map, and you had to conquer territories, and you got to hire the ninja, which everyone always wanted to do, despite the ninja in the game being actually kind of garbage. But you wanted to have that ninja miniature in front of you just to threaten that I've got the ninja. And at 14, that made perfect sense. As an adult, I realized that, oh my God, that was a waste of money in the game. But those big box games certainly sit that same level of complexity for full-blown versions of 40K and Age of Sigmar because you have a lot of rules, a lot of moving parts, and it requires a longer attention span. More than anything else, I think it's the attention span that hurts kids when it comes to tabletop games, which is why I think winding it back to sort of that Shadespire level is really good for those early teens or preteens in terms of game.
Having said that, I mean, I do have to say that we've got players who came along to the Youngblood event in January and
then WATC.
And then WATC. Now, I think nine?
I think he's 9 or maybe 10. He's certainly not much more than that.
And then we've got another player who's been coming for, I think, the last 12 months, who's the same age as our eldest, so he's 13 now. And then we've got another player who started when he was 14 coming to all of our events.
Yeah, there's a few of the kids who, that sort of 10 to 15 age group, who, it's probably half a dozen of them now.
Yeah.
Who've been coming along to organise play and playing against adults, and while their win streaks might not necessarily be that hot, the fact that they're
playing four games in a day
against adults in a crowded room. Well, not too crowded, but in some events it has been quite crowded.
Well, WATC was crowded.
Yep. And they've had to stand across the table and play these adults who can be, you know, the authority figure mentality comes into play with kids that age, and they they'll
actually, with those particular kids, it doesn't.
No, they are bosses. Some of them are awesome.
Yeah, absolutely no qualms in going, that's not right. Show me where it says that in the rules.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
But no,
I hope they never lose that.
Yeah, likewise. And those kids have obviously been playing this. I know one of the parents plays or used to play, and there's obviously an exposure level there to it. And I think that's... You know, when you do have those kids who have a real obsession with playing it, they will learn those games easily and earlier than you would expect. But I think, you know, engaging kids that age with something like Shadespire or Necromunda, where it is more of a board game with miniatures as opposed to a miniature game, is a really good segue into proper tabletop gaming if you're not sure as a parent that you want to sink money into a game that the kid might not want to play in a year's time. At least if you're buying a board game style thing like Shadespire or Necromunda, then you are getting the miniatures, they are getting that connection with, particularly Shadespire, since the miniatures are literally lifted out of Age of Sigmar.
Yeah.
you've got that connection to the game without having to go down the road of spending $500, $600, $700, $800 on an army that the kid might not want. Whereas if you spend $90 on a board game, you can pull it out whenever you feel like it with the kids. And
whereas if you spend $90 on models,
it's a box set and a pack of paints or something and you're done.
But the thing is, you can't actually play
with them. You
can't
do anything, yeah.
So they're, you know, if the hobby that you love is building and painting models, awesome. But if you want to get into it to actually play the game...
Well, they do the baby starter sets these days, which are sort of that $100 range for both Age of Sigmar and Warhammer Fantasy, Warhammer 40,000. But again, it's a more complicated game and it's less likely to be a, we can pull this out and play it with the family than it is to be, you know, you then need to think about a tabletop and terrain and all that other sort of stuff that comes into the game. Whereas at least with a board game, it's kind of... in a box, you pull the box out and you play.
Tabletop and terrain. It's the dining table with a sheet, 3 shoe boxes, a frosty box, a yogurt container, and you're set.
We used to drape a green felt blanket, put books down, stack the books up, and then put the felt over the top. Yeah. That was the go-to.
I actually saw that not too long ago in an event that was happening in the UK.
At 12, I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Hmm.
At an event, yeah.
Oh, look, it offered some heels.
Yeah, moving on.
Yeah.
So when you actually start talking about box games with miniatures, which is ultimately where I think a lot of the fascination for kids comes from, is the actual miniatures, because cards have pictures on them and that's kind of nice, but having a model is... it's like having a toy, essentially. It's like having a Lego toy or a
stuff you can collect.
Yep.
Kids love stuff that you can collect. Our kids love stuff that you can collect.
Absolutely.
Which is why when I was saying before about kids starting to read the book and then wanting to buy the models and the miniatures, as a parent, I really struggle now to find things to buy our kids for birthdays and Christmases.
Yeah.
With our older two, our younger ones still, you know, just give her dolls and dress-ups and she's all good. But so I would kind of love it. Because if I could just go in there and go, okay, so her favourite character is this particular female from this, you know, and to be able to go in and buy that.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome. Tick that off.
Look, I could seriously consider, I think it wouldn't be out of the realms of possibility for Games Workshop to go down the road of turning this into a completely separate line where... Mm. You don't just buy the miniatures. You might even be able to get like box game type stuff where it is a certain scene from one of the books and you get 3 or 4 miniatures in it and you get to play out that part of the story in the game. I don't think that's out of the realms of possibility at all. I think it's almost likely at this point. And I think that's really good because it's a very good way of them engaging the next stage of hobbyists, the ones that will continue to grow the community and to continue to support events and be part of things.
And it is, it's interesting with the characters that they've chosen. So I'm digressing back to the, where we started, but, you know, I'm sure we'll hit a different tangent in a minute. So looking at it, they've got different genders. They've got
ethnic diversity.
Different cultural and linguistic backgrounds. Actually, I don't know about linguistic because I haven't read the book, but let's go different cultural backgrounds. They've got kids... I don't like using the word disability, but they seem to have kids with different abilities or different physical...
attributes?
Yeah. So things like bionic arms and that kind of stuff. So it seems to be really inclusive that way. And
well, it's certainly a far cry from where the hobby would have been when I was a kid getting into it, when it was a very male-dominated... boys club, essentially. And I don't know whether that was a cultural thing at the time where the, you know, the 80s were still very much, you know, you had boys' toys and girls' toys and that sort of thing. And that just might be the fact that the times have changed. But it's...
I hope it's that. I hope it's that they're actually trying to... They're actually going, you know what, this can be a really fun game for boys and girls. And this is something that... regardless of being neurotypical or neuroatypical or having different physical limitations or that kind of thing. It's something that people can be brought together and play as equals across a table or share this story and I hope it's not being done.
Just purely for a political angle? It certainly doesn't feel like that so far. They've been going to great lengths in the main game and in their posts and all their... it certainly felt a little bit forced at first, but it's felt less and less like that as the time's gone on with the different change that the company's
taken. Maybe that's just as you get used to it.
It could be.
Fake it till you make it, and then you're finally sort of starting to make it.
Well, let's not be cynical, and let's assume
I wasn't being cynical. I wasn't. I was just saying, at first, things feel a little bit awkward, and when you push through that awkwardness, you start to get used to it, and it starts to feel normal and natural, and so,
Well, they've certainly gone down that road of trying to make it all inclusive, and I think the danger they have is just walking that fine line between keeping the older gamers happy and obviously growing as a business, and you've got to walk that line of the old versus the new customer base. And I think at the moment they're doing a decent job of it. So
surely providing they keep continuing to offer and support the products that they're currently offering, it's not going to impact on the current gamers by offering something different to encourage younger gamers to be
Look, players. I know that makes complete sense.
It does.
But that's not the way this works.
I know. I've read the forums.
There's plenty in that topic that's almost as icy and dangerous as the other topic around bolt action we were talking about that is a bit of a sensitive one. So we might wander back into the worlds of Simple Hammer as opposed to diversity and representation in gaming. That might be another topic for another day.
So our plan is that once we've been doing this for a little bit longer, then we'll start getting a little
something a bit more controversial.
Yeah.
When you actually start talking about gaming, starting with any of those really cool, engaging board games and card games is a really easy one. Magic the Gathering has come and gone over the years. It's really popular at the moment. I remember when it came out as a kid and we played it for a bit, and then we moved on to MechWarrior, the card game, and Alien vs. Predator, the card game, and a whole bunch of them that it spawned spin-offs of.
Yeah.
And Magic's another really, in theory, low buy-in, which we've played with our kids. Yeah. 20, 30 Australian dollars for a starter deck each, plus a couple of boosters. And again, a fairly simple mechanic. I really wish they made it more accessible to know what some of the special rules did, because the books that were in those starter decks were terrible. They didn't tell you anything.
I actually didn't even know that there were books in there.
The little instruction pads that you never read for anything.
Yep.
That's why I'm building the Shadespire kit and you're not.
Yeah, that's why.
What else is there? We've also done... Swing. Yeah, we've done a little bit of X-Wing now. X-Wing's about to have Mark II released, and that creates its own little issue. I don't see me buying Mark II in the short term to play with the kids, because Mark I works fine. I've got all the models, I've got all the cards, I've got everything I need to play with them.
And at the moment, none of us are likely to be attending X-Wing tournaments as players.
No.
So I don't think that we necessarily need to invest in the new system, because we can continue playing with what we've got.
Yeah. I think X-Wing's another one where you can make it as complicated as you like, where you can slowly add in some of the special rules and some of the upgrade cards for the ships, and you can change the game a little bit at a time, much like Shadespire did.
So our son would have been, eight when maybe you first started playing that with him?
Yeah.
And that was very, very much like you say, really simplifying the rules and then adding in more layers of complexity.
Yeah. Well, I mean... we started with just the dice and the maneuver dials and the templates as to how you moved, and then we slowly added in things like target locks and some of the special rules the ships had, and then we went into upgrade cards so that he could play Han Solo flying the Millennium Falcon with the Chewbacca co-pilot with all the things you see in the movies. But that game's, for us, again, it's less about it being a war game and more about it being a board game, essentially, to have a laugh and watch Han try and shoot down TIE fighters.
Just as another tangent, it's really unlike me. I know you're going to know that. We homeschooled one of our kids for 3 years, and there's a big movement at the moment in Australia called game schooling, which is basically basing a homeschool curriculum on board games.
That's really cool. I didn't know about that.
Yeah. probably should have talked about this before, so we had more to talk about. but yeah, so it's really interesting. So our son is no longer homeschooled, but I'm still part of a lot of those groups, and it's interesting seeing people talk about, you know, when they can introduce games and how they can use these games as they're adding in more of these complex rules, how they can use these to meet some of the curriculum outcomes as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of the things that we've talked about with Warhammer 40,000 is that, so you've got maths is covered, and so, you know, different strands within the math is covered. So with your probability and your measurement and geometry, so there's, you know, lots of things in there that's covered. You've got your English covered with being able to read and understand the rules, being able to make the connections between, you know, the self and
like mechanical process type stuff.
No, but also being able to make connections between what you're reading and what's happening in the real world, or what you're reading and what's happening in other stories, or so there's those kinds of connections. Then through like the HASS stream, being able to look at the different terrain that's on the table and where is that representative of, and, you know, so all of those kinds of things you're able to use as part of the there's educational purposes and educational value for all of that kind of stuff as well. Oh,
absolutely. I know at one point there, actually I say I know as much as I'd read it, and it was true because I read it. There was at one point there in my late teens, I'd probably left high school by that stage when I read this, but I know there were schools, I had heard there were schools in the UK that were using a semester to teach Warhammer, essentially, where the first semester was all about art and design and writing an army list. There was a little bit of mathematics there, and it was about building a little army and painting it and understanding the stories and trying to create a theme. So it's kind of mostly English and art driven, and then a little bit of maths at the end. And then the second semester was all about probabilities and measurements and calculations. And obviously there's a component there of sportsmanship that's developed through winning and losing games as well. And I know that at the moment Games Workshop, in the UK at least, have a school program that they will supply stuff to schools to set up clubs that run at the schools.
Yeah.
It'd be awesome if they'd want to bring it over here. They're more than welcome to get in touch with us and we can help them instigate that. So there's definitely educational benefits to it. I think, like all kids though, you have to balance that, particularly at school age, with their other exposures, to make sure they're not overexposing in one area necessarily to the extent that it's having an impact negatively on other parts of their education.
No, but I personally don't think that it is, because it's all about incidental learning and real world learning.
Yeah.
You know, so when you're actually using this stuff for probability, kids are learning what probability is. Whereas when you're filling out a worksheet about probability, it's a worksheet.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, when we did homeschool our son, it was all about real world stuff.
Yeah.
So when he was, you know, when he was doing design and technology and when he creating, he actually built things, which meant when he was learning about circumference, he was doing it by having to out circles.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think that's what some of the board games offer, is actually real world experience that cements learning.
Yeah, and look, I mean, it's also subliminal learning in a way, because they don't necessarily treat it as a...
Yeah, you don't say, we're sitting down and doing a lesson. Let's,
it's Warhammer lesson time, kids.
Yeah.
You know, all those probability calculations and things like that. Obviously, as you get older and you start using it in gaming, you do use it all the time. And I suspect that it could be used for various nefarious or less legitimate options as well for people in the community. But at the same time, yeah, a lot of those calculations, it's like when you hear people say that they never use algebra. Another day and I've never used algebra again.
This is my biggest soapbox.
Yeah, which is just flat out not true for 99% of the adult population.
Well, pretty much any functioning adult uses algebra more often than they most likely.
But they just
realize.
Don't do it with X plus Y equals Z like they were taught in school.
Yeah.
So I like to think of it like that, where the kids are learning stuff that they will use, they just don't realize it yet, because it's fun and they're enjoying themselves and they'll remember.
You learn
it.
When you're having fun.
Yeah,
you don't
absolutely.
Learn when you're bored.
So,
Mummy, again, why we sent him back to school?
So I could paint more miniatures during the day. Mm. So, okay, let's move on to Shadespire from our last topic. I mentioned in that episode, I taught our 5-year-old the dice side of it with one miniature each. I don't think she could handle any more than that. I think at 5, she's still too young for that game. Anything more than rolling dice and a very direct, I'm going to charge you and hit you with my hammer, is probably past her.
You don't think she could do 3 models on there with that particular army?
Maybe. But it is only a maybe. I think the I go, you go mechanic, particularly since I would have 5 models and she would only have 3, mm-hmm. that might not go down so well because she's still not...
she'd pick the one with 5. Because she's 5.
That is true. In terms of basic mechanics,
Kevin
though...
Kevin help us when she turns 6. Because we haven't got a team with 6 models.
No, she has to wait until she's 7. So I think she's probably a little bit too young for that game as it stands at the moment. I think both the older kids would pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
It'd take a couple of games before you introduced everything into the game in terms of the cards and stuff. And I also think that the way they would play that game would be very similar to Catan, and that it would be very linear in regards to, I draw the cards, I have to score these cards. There'd be no tactical choices of discarding and, you know, the upgrade cards, the picture is this one, so it goes on that one type stuff. I don't think there'd be a lot of tactical choices there. Or even just the case of, oh, I've got a card that says I have to hold an objective, but I really want to go and punch that guy in the face. So I'm going to go and punch that guy in the face at the expense of scoring that objective card.
It's a choice. We all have choices to make.
What I'm saying is that the level of tactical acumen might not 100% be there. I think that's fair anyway.
Yeah, no, definitely. It is.
But in terms of them learning the game, they could play it.
Yeah, they could definitely play it. And I think that the more they played it, the more likely that they start to develop those tactical skills. But that's the same with anyone.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's the same when I was, you know, first playing it. I struggled with adding in the different layers and then reading the objectives and going, okay, and, you know, you just got to practice.
Yeah. And that sort of neatly segues into, you know, moving on to full-blown tabletop gaming, because if you can get your head around Shadespire with 3 models or Necromunda with, you know, like the dozen aside for that particular game, you end up in this situation of scaling where by the time that you are comfortable playing Shadespire and Necromunda, the natural step into those tabletop games, yes, it is a different rule set, but you've probably got all the tools at your disposal to be able to read the rules, understand them, and then apply them, and then know how to go and seek other information if you don't have any clarity on a situation that arises in a game. So I think the cognitive reasoning side of things means that those tabletop games are probably suited to those early teen years as opposed to any younger than that. And I'm only talking general here. I mean, I'm sure
Yeah, of course, there's exceptions to every rule.
But at the same time, I think that the opportunities now for the younger gamer, without having to plunge neck deep into a full-blown tabletop game, and whether that's... you know, typically, that will be Age of Sigmar or Warhammer 40,000 these days because they're the only store, like the Games Workshop's the only store.
So that's how you get exposed to it.
Exactly.
Because I guess the other way that you get exposed to the different game systems is by going to the clubs.
But you don't know they exist.
Well, not only that, there's not a lot of parents who are happy to go out on a Tuesday or Friday night.
At 8 o'clock until 11 or 12
o'clock. 11 o'clock with their 11-year-old.
Yep. And so you tend to gravitate to the stores that it can be done on a Saturday afternoon after sport or...
Or you happen to be walking past it in the city or...
And though at that point, then the kids can kind of get stuck into it. So you get introduced by Games Workshop and so the natural tendency is to go down that road. And if we have those younger gamers having that opportunity where mum can go and spend $95 on a box of Shadespire for a birthday and...
Which does still seem like a lot. Just saying. Look, when you put it into perspective, it's not... But I think for a lot of parents who are used to seeing $20 and $30 games at Target and Big W, $95 for Shadespire still seems like a bit, how much for a board game?
Yeah. I suppose I'm part
of... How about we just get you Trouble instead?
Yahtzee. I think part of it, though, is, again, exposure to the scene. Like, I think a lot of parents would still treat any sort of tabletop gaming as a kid's thing. I think there's still a stigma attached to it in some ways that you play with toy soldiers, you play with little toys. And
see, that's really funny because I don't associate it with kids at all.
No, and that, but that's what I'm saying is the reality is a very different thing.
Yeah.
Because the disposable income combined with the complexity, combined with the patience, combined with a whole raft of factors means that the average wargamer isn't 13 years old. The average wargamer is
18 to 35.
I was going to say, well, I would have put it at early to mid-20s. Probably 23 to 26 would be my average.
I was basically going from the stats that I got from Games Workshop.
Yeah.
I was saying, 18 to 35, relatively high disposable income.
Yeah. And I don't think that social connection has been made by a lot of parents yet. The kids who are playing now, aged 10 to 12 to 13, I think are at that cusp of another change in the social dynamic and the social acceptability of playing more complex board games than Yahtzee or Trouble or Connect Four or any of those other sorts of games, where we're now seeing a resurgence of that family-orientated activity away from computer games and away from the screens, so that everyone gets a chance to be part of the family and play something together. And I think the value that they put on the board games at $95 Australian for Shadespire, when you can sit down with another family member and cycle through the games quick. You can easily play two or three games in half an hour. Particularly
you can't play two or three games in half an hour.
If you're bad enough at it, you could be.
two or three games in an hour.
But my point is, though, that you could... That the value of that social time with your family for something that's a little bit more complex, it's a little more interesting and engaging for the family.
Look, I know that.
Yeah.
But my point was just that when you first see $95 for a board game, it's shocking.
Yeah.
I am still shocked every time I walk in and we want to get a board game. I'm like, oh my God, it's $130. Is this actually going to be good?
that's the hardest part, I think, for picking games. And certainly... We've done a lot of research when we've read about some of their games, because you are investing some decent money there. Mm. And if it's crap, well, that's money. Essentially, it's money wasted. So it is important that you do a little bit of homework and find out what the game's like. And if you've got someone else who you know who has it, ask if you can borrow it or play it with them.
Yeah.
And actually make sure that it's something that your kids are going to be interested in. I mean, ultimately, it has to be engaging for them. If you want them to be part of that sort of learning, not necessarily just learning, but part of that social interaction with games, whether it's board games or tabletop games, it has to be engaging for them. Because if they're not interested, it's just wasting everyone's time.
Yeah. And I think that's probably one of the things that I love most about about board games and about the events that we run, is that there is that social connection that's really missing from society at the moment. We live in a social age, and yet there's just no social.
Yeah. And you know, now we're showing our age at this point.
I know. Yeah. But I'm proud of my age because I'm still very young, unlike you.
Yeah. Look, I still will claim youth purely because when you suggested for my 40th birthday to go to Warhammer World and I could go and spend the day at Warhammer World for my 40th birthday, I still giggled like a kid. So when...
There's a difference between youth and immaturity.
That is true. But you know what? Like the fact that I've now got a hobby that's spanned this long, you know, it's given me a lot of enjoyment over the years and some frustration along the way as well. But now I've got kids who are like, our son has asked a couple of times, hey, can we maybe try this out? We've got Shadespire that I'm painting at the moment. I really want to get that. I finished one of the Liberators. I've got the other two about half done. And I want to get two painted ones so that we can do some videos of you and I playing. But I also want to do some of me playing him or you playing our daughter. Or I think it'd be really cool to have a next generation playing alongside us and playing these games. So, you know, I'm sure that at some point we'll probably end up with all eight of the warbands.
Yeah, I'm sure we will.
And you got three so far. And from what I understand...
I can see Necromunda arriving pretty soon as well.
No, not yet. Although they did just release my favourite gang.
Mm.
I haven't bought it yet.
Yet.
Yet. It's a big yet.
Mm.
Moving on. Look, all I can say is I would encourage you, if you have children and they are... It doesn't matter how old they are, actually. If they want to sit down with mum and dad and play a silly game with cards or dice or whatever it happens to be, I'd embrace that and engage it with them, even if it is Monopoly.
No, not Monopoly. Not Monopoly. Do you know what I saw the other day? This particular person had, I think it was like 497 versions of Monopoly.
Oh, yeah, from all around the world and all
Why?
The... Well, I can guarantee you if they're collecting them like that, it's not to play them. They'll all be mint in plastic on the shelf and hopefully never open for the human eyes. But back to my point.
Oh, was there a point?
There was a point. I don't think there's any age too young to be playing board games with your kids. I think that there is something that you can access, whether it's something really simple like Connect Four or some of those really $20 or $30 games that you can buy off the department store shelves, and then engage them as they get older and slowly introduce them to those bigger box games as they get more older and more confident. I think there's an opportunity there for really a close-knit connection between you and your kids, as well as the next generation of gamers coming through and wanting to play tabletop games and wanting to be in that moment as opposed to computer games.
Providing that the adult who's playing is enjoying themselves as well.
Yeah.
Because if you're not, that's going to pass on to the kids.
Yeah, exactly.
So, while I agree, and we've got plenty of those $20 and $30 board games from the department stores, the ones that are so incredibly boring have accidentally got broken and ended up in the bin because I hate them and I don't want to share, I don't want to pass on a hatred of board games to our kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'd much rather play a game with them that's going to have us laughing together and talking.
Like Poopy Head?
Like Poopy Head, where you refuse to put the poopy on your head.
Yep, I'm sorry. I draw a line there.
Yeah.
I'm immature to a point.
Yeah.
Wear them as earmuffs, though.
No, you didn't.
I would.
But yeah, like Poopy Head, which is also not a cheap game, but it's fun. It's just silly and fun.
And that's what games should be. If you're not having fun, then...
Actually, that's really good fun. We should play that again tomorrow night.
Well, after that ringing endorsement for a game around poop, we'll be right back to wrap up the episode. Right, so Simple Hammer turned out to be not so simple in the end. And the reason I got the Simple Hammer description in at the start of everything was to make sure that that basic mechanic was shared with as many people as would listen to this. Because if nothing else...
That's 10 of you that should have heard it.
Shut up. if nothing else, it means that you do have an idea of how you can start playing board games, tabletop games with your kids right now. Because if you're listening to this... Logically, you have some sort of connection to miniature gaming, which means you have miniatures at home and you have dice at home.
If you don't have children at home, I don't recommend going and picking
some
up from the park.
No,
so
probably
you can
not.
Come and play this game. So maybe just hold out till you have your own and there.
And maybe wait until they're not going to try and like put the dice up their nose and that sort of thing.
Or the lead model in their mouth or...
Super glue their mouth shut or...
Oh, well, I did that the other day, so... I don't
think
that's an age-related.
You should not be
thing.
Allowed near super glue.
I know, you keep telling me that, and yet I'm still the one that keeps repairing all the terrain.
Well, you just need to get a better assistant.
I do.
I'm the boss. I'm not the assistant. Don't look at me like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Says who?
Me. I'm the one recording this, and I can edit it how I like.
Junior vice president says on your business card.
So... We hope you've gotten a little bit out of this and engaging kids with games. I think it's something that we really enjoy doing and playing games with the kids. And hopefully as they get older, they'll continue to play different board games and maybe some tabletop with dad. But
hopefully they will be encouraged to actually go out and find games that they enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and know that there is such a diverse range of games out there and available. And, you know, go out, play them, play as many as you can. Find the one that you gel with and that brings you joy. There's not enough joy in the world. Do things that bring you joy.
Absolutely. So on that very uplifting note, we're going to wrap the episode up. Thank you very much for listening. And we will see you for the next episode.
You've been listening to the Objective Secured podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website, objectivesecured.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/objectivesecured, or you can email us, obsec@optusnet.com.au. Thanks for listening.